him to sit up here? Or?
Look, no, it's fine.
No? Okay. Peter, thank you for appearing this morning. What we're proposing to do is to just have you briefly speak to your submission, and then what I'd like to do is raise some questions with you from the submission, if that's okay. But please, if you'd like to make some introductory remarks.
Yes, thanks very much. And I come here to provide some input for the inquiry in respect of the perspectives that the private sector employer community would have on this, on these issues. Mm. I think the first thing to say is that the decision of ACCI to engage in this inquiry is an important one. It does reflect the desire to respect the issue and see it and publicly see it as being an important issue in the contemporary society, in our contemporary workplace. There aren't, looking at the list of submitters, a lot of businesses or employer representatives who have come before the inquiry, and we're seeking to provide, I think, important perspectives as you come to consider your work.
Mm. Thank you. Can I say at the outset we appreciate that, that it has been a valuable contribution to the inquiry.
I think perhaps the major features that I could point to in terms of what we're bringing to the inquiry is firstly to underscore the principles of equal opportunity and the promotion of inclusive employment practices. The business community as a whole does have a long experience now over the last 20 or 30 years with working with equal opportunity legislation. It's got a high degree of support within the business community. The debates that occur tend to be about the areas where discrimination legislation should or shouldn't be extended, and whether black letter legislation is an effective solution to particular problems. What we are saying to this inquiry is that it would be important for the inquiry to be able to raise the profile of these issues so that in workplaces where ultimately decisions have to be made between employers and employees, these matters can be resolved, given that we do not have any community-wide consensus on the issue of the recognition of same-sex relationships. And I think that is the reality that confronts this inquiry, that as industry we see an active debate within within our community, within our governments, within our parliaments, about the issue of recognition of same-sex relationships, and that is not something which is a settled question in the community. It's certainly not something that's achieved a consensus basis. We've seen various parliaments enact civil union legislation. We've seen other parliaments drag the chain on that. We've seen other parliaments reject legislation which would provide recognition in terms of marriage. So it's a very open question. And in that context, the issue before the inquiry is, well, what, if anything, should be the responsibilities that employers should carry, and how should those responsibilities be given effect to? Our basic proposition is that it would be quite wrong for governments to try and impose on employers some mandatory economy-wide obligations in advance of government itself dealing with the questions in a conclusive way. Having said that, I think the real issue here is to try and recognise what employers are doing and to encourage employers to provide an workplace environment and a workplace culture that can facilitate the workplace entitlements of persons in same-sex relationships. We as employers would be reflective generally of the overall views in the community. There will be employers who have very progressive and engaging views on this question, and for whom it would simply be not a matter of controversy to recognise persons in same-sex relationships. At the same time, there will be employers and private businesses who would have a different view. And in talking about the workplace environment, it's not just a matter of an individual employee's view in respect of their relationship with the employer, but often workplace environments and cultures are affected by the views of employees as a whole. And so there is also an issue about trying to provide a work environment where people feel comfortable to be able to identify the need for leave or identify the need for a particular change in work practices to accommodate the circumstances that they or a same-sex partner have come into contact with. And sometimes that's not just a factor of the employer's conduct, it's also a factor of the workplace environment created by the whole of the workforce that works in that business. We also say in our submission that there are a number of ways in which formalising rights can occur through our employment law. One of those ways is for legislation to be changed, and I made the point earlier that in advance of the issue of recognition being generally resolved through the parliaments, then simply changing legislation in respect of an employer obligations but not in respect of the obligations of governments or the community as a whole would be putting the cart before the horse. There are, however, a number of other ways in which these issues are dealt within workplaces. There is obviously opportunities for informal arrangements to be made, either as a matter of general HR practice or as a matter of employer policy or on a one-to-one basis with individuals. And there's also the capacity for rights to be established through the formal processes of workplace agreements. And in a situation like this, it's highlighted in our submission that you need a system of both individual engagement with employers as well as collective engagement with employers. And for many of the people in circumstances where this is important, there are many issues of a very personal character, very private character, where they may not want to bring those issues into a collective, industrial negotiation, where there have to be some mechanisms to be able to formalise their rights through direct dealing with employers. And the current structure of our employment law, fortunately, does facilitate that. It allows for collective agreements. It allows for individual agreements to recognise employment rights and to make them enforceable at law. Perhaps the final point to make is that there are a range of areas in which we think that industry can work with government and government agencies on programs of information, education and promotion. We found with a lot of other areas of discrimination law that even where rights may be established through legislation, the workplace environment largely regulates the confidence and capacity that individuals have to exercise those rights. And that is part of trying to provide a better understanding within the workplace on issues of discrimination, on the elimination of prejudice, on the elimination of generalised assumptions or historical notions which may not sit comfortably with a person in a same-sex relationship feeling comfortable talking to other employees or their employer about these issues. And so there are some I think there is scope for industry to be part of what should be a general community education and information programs that ultimately help reduce levels of prejudice and the like.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for those comments, and again for Aki's submission. It's very useful to have that for the inquiry. There's a number of issues from the submission that we'd like to raise with you, if we can. Has ACCI developed either any blueprint policies or any education programs to assist employers in ensuring no discrimination against same-sex couples?
We've developed a number of policy blueprints on discrimination issues, which include consideration of discrimination issues. And those policy blueprints are used by a range of business organisations throughout the country to endeavour to train, inform, educate employers in formal sessions on both the status of current law and the utility that these issues may have in the development of HR policies and practices. The underpinning principle we adopt is that good HR practices are practices which are founded on non-discriminatory principles.
Sure.
And we're very comfortable with that being reflected not just in HR practices, but in the current workplace relations laws, for example. There's prohibitions on any discrimination or unlawful termination and the like on the grounds of sexuality or sexual status. Those are matters which have really passed beyond the controversial state in industry and are quite readily accepted.
Are you able to make those policies available to the inquiry?
Yeah, we've referred in our submission to the workplace policy blueprint that we prepared.
Mm-hmm. Was that attached to your submission?
It wasn't attached to it.
No,
we can certainly make that available.
That would be helpful.
As a document. It covers more than just this area of discrimination law, but it certainly has components.
Sure.
About discrimination law and practices in there.
Mm.
On the 20th anniversary, I think it was, of the Federal Sex Discrimination Act in 2004, we also produced a policy analysis, as it were, of where Australian law had gone and how employers had responded over 20 years to developments in Australian law on discrimination issues, including those relating to discrimination on the grounds of sex or sexual status.
Okay, I think it would be useful if we were able to look at that. That would be helpful. Thank you. Have ACCI members expressed concern about the laws that discriminate against their gay and lesbian employees? And if so, where might those expressions be found?
As industry as a whole hasn't expressed a view about the recognition of same-sex relationships because of the point I made earlier that there are different views within industry on the question, as industry is generally reflective of different views in the community on the issue. Our most significant opportunities to input into those issues is through work that has been done in the Australian Industrial Relations Commission, where the Australian Industrial Relations Commission has, over the course of the 1990s and in the early years of this decade, conducted a number of arbitrations into what employment standards should be with respect to either parental leave or carer's leave or personal leave and the like. And in 1995, it was decided by the Australian Industrial Relations Commission that the concept of a person taking leave for their own personal sickness would be extended to include leave for the purposes of caring for the sickness of a person in the immediate family or in the household, and that decision made it clear that the concept of household for the purposes of a carer's leave entitlement would include a person who was in a same-sex relationship in the household, and that's not something that industry had a difficulty with. That's reflected in the current standards on personal leave in the Workplace Relations Act. However, expressed as a minimum standard because one of the issues that arises with that framework is that the definition of spouse, which the Australian Industrial Relations Commission adopted during the 90s and which has still continued to be the case in the current law, is not a definition that includes a person in a same-sex relationship. So the effect of that is that that's not regarded as part of the immediate family, and so the scope for a same-sex relationship or person in a same-sex relationship to be able to access carer's leave in the minimum standards is if they are actually living in the household. So obviously if people are living in separate households, which is clearly a living arrangement which occurs and could occur quite readily, then that industrial entitlement would not apply as a minimum standard. But as we point out in our submission, there's been a range of agreements made where the minimum standards have been built on and supplemented by employers and employees reaching agreements in businesses. And so long as those agreements don't become a mandatory obligation on others, then that's a perfectly proper approach, and that's the way in which, at least in the current environment, where the issue of recognition is unresolved, that rights can be strengthened and made enforceable.
The law is clearly lagging on certain workplace issues like parental leave and for same-sex couples. What sort of advice does ACCI provide to its members in these circumstances?
Two-pronged advice. The first is to obviously inform employers of what the legal obligations are, so what the minimum standards are, the things that are absolutes you must do. Secondly, to inform employers that they are minimum standards and that the minimum standards are not structured in a way that they're intended to simply be reflective of all of the practices of industry, and that the employer would be well advised to deal with this issue in terms of good human resource management, and that is to identify the staff member concerned as a valuable and important part of the labour force, to identify the principles and values that underpin the culture of that organisation, and then for the business to discuss with the staff member concerned what the response could be. So in shorthand way, our advice is know what legal obligations you have, but examine what the circumstances are which could give rise to you doing something better than those legal obligations.
So, for example, you can provide advice to member employers to provide entitlements greater than that required by law?
Oh, certainly can, and we certainly can. Our advice is predicated, though, on the basis that these are decisions that are to be made by the businesses in conjunction with their staff. They're not going to be decisions that are made in some doctrinaire way by industry organisations or the like. They're going to be ultimately going to have to be decisions made by those businesses having regard to the type of value base on which they wish to employ, the type of principles that underpin the culture of that business, and also having regard to obviously the important role that the individual plays in their business.
Has ACCI had the opportunity to speak to government about the difficulties that these sort of anomalies in the law raise? I mean, the sort of anomalies that relate to couples in same-sex relationships.
We have spoken to government about the importance of government not abdicating its responsibility for dealing with a community issue, but simply trying to pass the buck, as it were, onto employers. I think that point's been made clear in our submission. It is an important principle. In circumstances where there is an unresolved debate in the community, government obviously has to take decisions that it believes are appropriate, but in doing so, it should not create an environment where employers become the easy target for government simply saying we'll regulate in this area but we'll not regulate in some other area.
Yeah. Okay. Your submission provides a brief overview of the use of Australian workplace agreements as one way of recognising same-sex relationships in the workplace. And you comment that individual negotiations are more likely to allow recognition of same-sex relationships than collective negotiations. Can you give examples of employers who've recognised same-sex relationships in their workplace policies and practices?
Well,
and in AWA?
Yeah. Our submission isn't that an individual arrangement is a superior vehicle. Our submission is that an individual relationship can be a better vehicle in particular circumstances. See, what we're trying to say here is that you may be able to achieve the formalisation of greater rights through a collective bargaining process. It may be that a union or a group of employees can negotiate collectively with an employer to provide those rights in a particular workplace. Mm. But it may also be that a majority of employees in that workplace don't agree with that view. Collective agreements can only exist where a majority of employees agree with that view and the employer. That's the only circumstance in which you can have a collective agreement entered into. Now, in circumstances where a majority of employees may not agree to provide that particular recognition, there needs to be a mechanism available for those rights to be established where the employer and the individual concerned believe they want to create enforceable rights. And that mechanism is available through the existence of AWAs or other forms of statutory individual bargaining. The removal of the right for individual bargaining as a way to create enforceable rights is actually removing an avenue available for people to establish individual rights, particularly on issues like this where there are individual circumstances where individuals may not feel comfortable about being seen as the standard bearer in a workplace for that workplace creating broadly based employment rights for recognition of same-sex couples. Well, some people will feel comfortable doing that, others won't feel comfortable doing that. Those who don't feel comfortable doing that should still have some mechanism for creating enforceable rights. And I think that I've had a look at some of the views that have been put to the inquiry on this question, and I think that it's a very narrow view to be saying that these things are better achieved through collective bargaining and not individual bargaining. I think that they can be achieved through both forms of agreement, and it would be wrong to exclude the capacity for individual agreements to be made.
Mm.
As to the question of the actual agreements that are being made, because of the provisions of the Workplace Relations Act that provide for individual agreements to be confidential, we don't have access to the individual agreements. By definition, these are agreements between an individual employee and their employer, and it's only with the consent of both parties that those agreements can be made public. What we do have, though, is employers telling us that those employers who are moving into the recognition of same-sex relationships are doing it in one of three ways. They're either doing it through an informal HR practice or arrangement with an employee, or they're doing it formally through the creation of enforceable legal rights in either Australian workplace agreements or collective agreements.
Okay. You may have already addressed this question enough, but let me ask you again. Happy to hear you further on it if you want. Why do you consider that recognition of same-sex relationships as opposed to heterosexual relationships is often a private and individual matter?
Well,
how is it any more private or individual than a heterosexual relationship?
Well, a person's sexuality is a very personal thing.
Yes, but
the disclosure of a person's sexuality is a private matter, and it's a matter that individuals at various points in their life may have different views on. The reality is that it is something which should not be forced on people to enter into some form of public process by which these things are dealt with. I think that it is important that we understand that whilst there are people who are very comfortable with the public disclosure of their sexuality, there are also people who are not, and even that can extend to people who are in same-sex relationships.
But wouldn't that be less problematic if same-sex relationships were treated the same way as heterosexual relationships?
Oh, I think if you got to the point where the community through its parliaments as a whole recognised same-sex relationships in an equal way to heterosexual relationships, then that would put this issue to bed,
yeah,
as it were.
You're saying you don't think business should do it before parliaments do it?
Well, business shouldn't have a regulatory regime put onto it before parliament should.
Yeah, okay, I understand that. I mean, you made that point, and I understand that.
I think what we've got to do is to, in the absence of the capacity to legislate across the board on these issues, we've got to look at the other mechanisms by which people can firstly access some recognition of their relationship, and secondly have some of that recognition made legally enforceable.
Yeah.
I'll explain the mechanisms available for that.
Sure. No, you have. We've heard from a number of people that coming out to an employer in order to negotiate an AWA can be very difficult. So how would you take account of this possibility in the context of negotiating entitlements in an AWA?
Well, it would be even more confronting if you not only had to do that to an employer, but to all of the workforce as a whole through in a collective process. That was perhaps my earlier
but
point.
But you mightn't have to do it, might you? If the bargain was negotiated collectively, it wouldn't require individuals to come out in the same way as if they were. If they needed to do it through an AWA.
Oh well, I wouldn't agree with that, because bargaining in and of itself doesn't create the right. The right is only created by the adoption of the agreement, and that's subject to the vote of a majority of employees.
Sure, but individuals don't have to come out in order to have that vote.
That's right. At the same time, in a bargaining process, the question is perfectly open to be asked by either the employer or other employees involved in the collective bargaining process. Why do we need this?
Well, isn't the answer to that question because there may be people in same-sex relationships in the workplace, and it's a difficult thing to have to come out in that regard, so we need to cover off that contingency.
Yeah.
Isn't that the answer?
That may be a perfectly valid answer to put. Whether that satisfies everybody else involved, the majority of employees at least,
those who vote for
is a different question. Well, and the point I'm making is that if that answer doesn't satisfy a majority of employees, then where is the individual left?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the question then is whether Australians as a group would be expected to treat people in the same way, irrespective of their relationship or not, and that's a question on which I suppose we all have views on.
Yeah, I mean, we just heard Nan McGregor's contribution there. I mean, extremely valuable contribution just from listening to it, in the sense that things aren't all rosy out there. Not everybody has the same view, and it just can't be assumed that a workforce as a whole is going to be sympathetic to the circumstances of a particular individual.
Okay. It's argued by a number of people that having an award as opposed to a collective agreement that guarantees certain rights, including access to leave and other entitlements for same-sex couples, is a better option, and this wouldn't require the person to out themselves. What's your view about that?
Well, as a statement, that's correct. It wouldn't require people to out themselves. My point is that people shouldn't be required to out themselves. And in circumstances where a collective bargaining process doesn't provide them then a benefit, then they need to be left with the opportunity of talking to the employer about it.
But that's outing themselves as well, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's outing themselves in a way in which they're not having to put the whole pressure on themselves that doing so in a public way in front of all the other workforce workers would. So at the end of the day, if rights are not established through some generic process, then they have to be established through engagement with the employer. Yeah. And engagement with the employer involves identifying the need for an issue or the need for a particular form of leave or the particular circumstance.
Mm. Okay. You mentioned in the submission that you're involved with the International Labour Organization on employers and participation, that ACCI's participated in the process of international standard setting on discriminatory law. Can you tell us or can you point the inquiry to some of the standards that would be helpful on the issue of non-discrimination against same-sex couples?
The International Labour Organization's got a few standards on discrimination-related issues. There is an ILO instrument 111, ILO standard 111, which deals with discrimination issues. I'm not sufficiently familiar with it to be able to tell you whether it specifically focuses on same-sex issues. But what I can say is that the development of ILO standards is is itself a very difficult process, because it involves trying to achieve a consensus between governments, multiple governments from around the world, yeah, many of whom have very oppressive and regressive policies on this very question.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I just thought that you might.
There's also a more recent ILO convention dealing with maternity entitlements, but look, from my memory, that doesn't specifically extend international maternity standards to same-sex.
Well, that's why I was interested to see whether the international standards did in fact address those issues. That's what I was looking for.
Look, I can't provide you with the degree of detail on that the question justifies.
In terms of leave, you talk about a number of test cases that have set the standard for paternity leave and family leave and personal carers leave and family provisions, and you list a number of awards that address same-sex relationships. Can you help us identify those awards that assist people in a same-sex relationship in those sorts of areas?
Well, in our submission, we've referred to a number of those. The process of making awards has been firstly through a general ruling. And this is a generalisation of the process, but it comes to the answer to your question. A generalised ruling by the Australian Industrial Relations Commission on the principles that should govern the content of awards. And then within those principles, on an individual industry basis, there is an examination of what the relevant award should provide. That's the way in which the award process has developed, or yep, developed in Australia over many years.
Yep.
What we've found is that recognition of same-sex entitlements tends to occur firstly through HR practices or policies that are widely applied in industry, yep. so that when they're put into awards, it's much more of a already generally accepted principle in a particular industry. And what we found is that awards applying in the public sectors tended to move in advance of awards applying in the private sectors in this area. And that's largely because because HR practices in the public sectors moved in advance of HR practices in the private sector over the past 20 years. What we do find, though, is that in the private sector, awards that deal with the entertainment industry, and I think there's a couple of those referred to in our submission, and for that matter, in some of the submissions from some of the unions who have put views to the inquiry, and in some of the service industries, have tended to deal with this issue more specifically. And that's often a product of a particular push from within the unions involved in that industry to see this as an important issue, and then use the powers that they historically had to go to the Industrial Relations Commission and seek variation of awards in those respects. Our work has been not been at the level of dealing with individual industry awards. Our work at ACCI has been at the level where the Australian Industrial Relations Commission dealt with its national standards or national principles for award making. Mm. And that's where I referred to the fact that over the course of the 90s and early 2000s, the Commission really only once specifically dealt with this question. There wasn't either a sufficient push from within the trade union movement or from within industry or the Commission of its own motion to say that it needed to develop a national ruling on this question.
Okay. In your summary of the work choices legislation, you note that one of the objects of the Act includes eliminating discrimination on the grounds of sexual preference. What's the Council's advice about reconciling the overarching non-discrimination provision in the objects of the Act and those definitions in the Act that exclude same-sex partners from certain benefits?
Well, it's not an incompatible proposition, because as with all legislation, there's an objective, and that objective is met in different ways. There are provisions of the legislation. I mentioned one earlier about non-discrimination in respect of termination rights on the grounds of sexuality. The individual standards, the individual legislative standards that are in the Act in respect of leave, have all flown from the arbitrated decisions of the Australian Industrial Relations Commission that I referred to earlier. And the question then is, and I think the point of your question is the object somehow not given proper effect to or full effect to by virtue of the fact that various of those leave entitlements do not include specific recognition of same-sex couples? I wouldn't say that that's a conclusion that you could draw, because a statutory objective points to the direction in which the legislation should operate in a range of areas: individual parts of legislation, individual entitlements in legislation still have to be based on, you know, what is the balance of interests, and the balance of interests in the development of those standards by the Australian Industrial Relations Commission took into account community attitudes at the time in developing the line that the Commission drew around the extent to which it would define family, or the extent to which it would define spouse, or the extent to which it would define household.
But this legislation is not rulings of the Commission, is it?
No, that the standards that are in the legislation are the minimum standards that derive from the minimum standards developed by the Australian Industrial Relations Commission. They were taken from the award system, and they were put into the work choice legislation.
Mm. Okay. Your submission raises concerns with the multiplicity of discrimination laws that exist in Australia, and you comment that this causes problems for employers. How do you assert that the state and federal laws create potential for double jeopardy?
Oh well,
because there are provisions in those pieces of legislation that prevent a person lodging a complaint under one if they've lodged under the other.
Yes, there are some of those provisions.
Yeah.
The first area is that you have you immediately create confusion in the minds of industry about what minimum rights and obligations are, where you've got two pieces of legislation, one created by a Commonwealth Parliament, one created by a state parliament, that say different things about the same issue. And the first question that we have to try and advise employers on is to say, well, does the Commonwealth law apply to you? Does the state law apply to you? Or do both laws apply to you?
Mm.
And that's a question of trying to assess whether or not the laws are, the Commonwealth law covers the field and various other constitutional tests. Once we've been able to determine that question, the issue then is, if both laws govern your rights and obligations, if there's inconsistency between both laws, how do you resolve that inconsistency? And I think this is where the issue of double jeopardy and the confusion of rights arises from an employer's point of view. We want laws on discrimination or on any other important public policy matter for that point of view to be as clear as possible. So we want the minimum standards to be as clear as possible. We don't want to be in a situation where we are in doubt about whether or not have to provide this or that particular right or entitlement in a workplace as a matter of law. Good public policy is simply that those issues should be clear. Two parliaments legislating creates confusion. Where both laws operate, then you have a scenario where there can be forum shopping for remedies, and that is not good public policy either.
But there isn't double jeopardy, is there?
And then you've got a double jeopardy situation where you've got a double jeopardy situation in circumstances where an employer can't specifically point to a provision in legislation which would act as some bar or some jurisdictional bar to an action being taken because there's been an action already pursued in another forum.
But you can't complain in one forum if you've complained in another.
Well, that's
the provisions are quite clear, aren't they?
That's a Sorry.
The provisions in the legislation are quite clear on that.
Well, it's a question of whether those provisions are clear and whether they exist in all legislation.
Well, can you tell me any that they don't?
I'd have to go back. No, I couldn't. Not just off the top of my head, I couldn't.
I think you'll find that's because they're in all the legislation. Okay. Look. Thank you. That's been very helpful. The submission has certainly brought an important perspective to the inquiry. That is the perspective of industry, and I appreciate the both the lodging of the submission and your expansion on points today. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much, and hope the inquiry proceeds to a good conclusion.
Thank you.